difference, I would say, between left and right is the difference between historicizing and naturalizing. If you're on the left, broadly speaking, you look at things and you say, what are the historical, material reasons why that is happening? If you're on the right, you say that is what it is. Now, paradoxically, this is actually a reason why right now there's a lot of conflict between people who are more socialistic and people who are more quote unquote, because their moral dimension is better. Look, America is a racist society is correct. Acknowledging that truth versus denying that truth is a major difference. No question. However, if you read Adolf Reed, who's one of my intellectual heroes, I really hope everybody is reading him, he will tell you why racism and white supremacy is a multi-generational project in America that depends on economic conditions, that manifests in different geographies, that is inseparable for how we produce and do capitalism. And actually, it might become separable, right? Whereas some people who have a woke discourse, it just is. It's the religious foundation of America. There's no difference between any different historical periods. It's just this moral block statement. Does that make sense? So some of these critiques can get really subtle, and that's actually what started to occur to me with the IDW and dealing with the right, because these guys were exploiting a lot of weaknesses. They were coming in and they were seeing people, you know, look, if your pop culture diet, and let's say you're an alienated young man, which is the primary audience for these guys. That's just market demographics. That's not a moral statement. I did some brand work. This is just like you're looking at your demos. You're alienated. You don't feel powerful. You probably have a lot of actually very valid complaints in your life. You flip open, say, some, you know, mediocre, bougie website that you think is the left, and what do you have? Seinfeld's actually problematic, and you suck, and shut the fuck up, and this is a problem, and that's a problem, and this is this, and da 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 da. And then Jordan Peterson comes along and goes, no, actually, you're great, and you should have a government-provided wife to massage you.
All right. I am Ben Burgess. This is Give Them an Argument. I am joined, as always, by our super producer, Jake Appett, and by our very talented graphic designer, J. Andrew World. Okay. That must be why my liver started to clench when we started recording. Matt McManus is in the house.
Yeah. Good to see you, everybody.
So we are going to be talking today all about this book, which was just officially released into the world, A How-To Guide to Cosmopolitan Socialism, a tribute to Michael Brooks. So we are going to be talking more about that very shortly. But I wanted to play that clip. I know it's something people on this channel have seen before, but, you know, wanted to play it at the beginning, both because I never get sick of it. It's a sort of perfect distillation of what Michael was doing with his book, Against the Web, and a lot of his political project in general, and, you know, whatever. Last part always makes me laugh. And I think it's a reminder of something I want to get into with Matt a little bit later on, which is, you know, I think that, you know, as the years pass, since the guy's been gone, I think there's this unfortunate tendency for people to sort of remember a little bit in ways that are very flat and leave out a lot of the complexity of what the guy thought, a lot of the texture of the ideas and I was talking to David Griscom, who, by the way, is going to be joining us in the post game today, about this the other day. And what I told him is that, it's like, sometimes I think people kind of disappear all of Michael's like substantive views, and, you know, he just kind of gets flat into this like parasocial Big Brother figure who, you know, made fun of Dave Rubin. And, you know, and
I think fair, nobody did a better job of it than him.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, look,
if you're going to watch one Dave Rubin takedown, then is this the one to watch?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, look, and I enjoyed that, right? But I also remember a lot of other stuff. That's one of the reasons I'm happy this book exists. And we're definitely going to talk about that. So a few other things first. I'm not in the studio tonight. And for the same reason, there might occasionally be meowing in the background. Last week I adopted a cat. The Hollywood Forever Cemetery had a bunch of kittens who needed homes, and so I adopted one of them. And this morning he got his gender non-affirming surgery. And so I figured I should be around.
You know, Ben, it should be an uncontroversial thing, Ben. You got a cat, make everybody love you, and then you got to toss in these cleaving issues, you know, these hot button issues.
Well, I
can't even talk about getting an animal anymore without making it woke somehow.
Well, you know, he's just honoring the memory of Bob Barker, who's no longer with us, who's up there in heaven with all the balls and of dogs and cats that have been spayed and neutered for
yeah. So once yeah,
you, I needed my cat back around 2021, and within like 2 weeks, he got like fucking twice as fat as he was before. So I was like, I'm not sure if this is a hormonal thing or if he just did like the middle aged man thing of being like, whatever, I can't reproduce anymore, I might as well let myself go. Or some combination of the two, because like there's a very clear before and after, and it like begins the day he got his dick or like his balls chopped off, and still feel a little guilty about that, if I'm being honest.
Yeah,
watch out for that, Ben.
Okay, well, it's a pretty tiny hyper energetic kitten, so I'm not too worried about it, but I suppose we'll see. But yeah, I figured I should be around. Keep an eye on him tonight. We'll probably be back in the studio for the debate breakdown on Thursday. Yes. Jokes aside, get some spayed and neutered. It's a good thing to do. in any case, I do have a couple things I wanted to get to before we start talking about Matt's book. So I had two articles out in Jacobin last week. The first was about the Republican debate. The GOP says it's working class party. Last night's debate exposed that charade. And I don't know. I'm not gonna inflict clips of the Republican debate on anyone. I don't know if you guys watched it or not, or watched any of it. But yeah, good call. Unfortunately, I watched every minute of it because I was writing about it for Jacobin. But it was pretty grim. It was way less entertaining than the first one. I think all the candidates kind of overlearned from the first one, and so they were both all kind of trying to be above it all in a weird way, but also for the most part, but then also they were just constantly talking over each other to try to get those like iconic moments where they would bust in and say the, you know, have the really good line that people would remember. And so a lot of it was just crosstalk and you couldn't really hear. There was a lot of rig and humping. There was like the lighting was even bad, like just on a production level, it was pretty bad. The moderation was really bad. The questions didn't really bring out like the things that would have been interesting to watch them argue about. It was a lot of, you know, we're pointing this out in Breaking Points. There was a lot of like, hey, you guys think crime is bad, right? Like there were a lot of questions along those lines. I don't know. It was just kind of exhausting to watch, and I felt dumber for having watched it. But the thing that was a little bit striking to me is after the last, what are we in 2023, the last 8 years of hearing about this populist pivot and how, you know, what did Josh Hawley say way back in 2016? You know, that's the GOP is the party of the working class now. It was really striking that the first question was about the auto worker strike in my home state. And they were all just like tripping over each other to deliver these pre-canned lines that felt like they'd been focus grouped with the Chamber of Commerce. Joe Biden shouldn't be on a picket line. He should be on the southern border. He shouldn't be on the picket line. He should be on the unemployment line. You know, even Vivek.
I believe people have a right to form a union, but I also believe that people have a right to work if that's what they want, right? Boy, oh boy, was that a quick pivot.
Yeah, a lot of that. Yeah, even Vivek, who was the only one who did like a moment of sympathy with the conditions of the workers. It was, you know, it was just a moment. He prefaced it with saying that he didn't like the union bosses, which is pretty amazing considering that not only is Sean Fain directly elected, but also, you know, it used to be that you'd be selected by, you know, lower down, you know, there's an indirect process. He was directly elected, but the strike authorization vote was 97%. So if you want to try to, you know, make some kind of distinction between the rank and file and, you know, the union bosses on that one, you know, you're going to have a hard case to make. The grossest line was enormous piece of shit, Chris Christie, who said that this was later in the debate, but he said the stranglehold of the teachers union on government won't be broken as long as the president is sleeping with a member of the union. Was the first lady as a teacher. That's the joke. Yeah.
That's it's easier than calling her Dr. Biden, right? You know, that might be too much of a bitter pill for them to swallow.
Yeah.
But Ben, you're forgetting the iconic line of the debate of Chris.
Right. Yeah.
I tweeted that, we're all going to remember where we were the moment that line dropped, right? Where he said,
"For those right of you, because I have not heard this yet."
Okay, I'm not going to. I know it from memory.
I'm so jealous, Andy. You get to hear this for the first time.
Yeah, so I'm going to paraphrase it, but basically, he said, "Like, you know, Donald, I know you're watching, and you're ducking this debate because you're scared. If you keep this up, we're not going to call you Donald Trump. We're going to call you Donald Duck." And it was
iconic. Yeah
it was like it was one of those moments of like I knew Mr. Kennedy, I knew Kennedy, you're no Kennedy, right? It was it's just gonna be taught in classes.
But the problem is now I'm picturing Trump walking around with no pants because that's Donald Duck.
I don't agree. I don't find Chris Christie likable, but I did that line, if I can drop the bit for a bit, was so lame that I liked it. Like he delivered it really confidently too, right? Like he does this little smirk.
Yeah, he really just thought that was his.
I will say there was one beautiful moment in the debate though, where somebody just actually outright asked them, like, "Hey, listen, aren't you guys all a bunch of losers? Because we all know that Trump is going to win anyway. Given that, can you explain to us like what this whole thing was about?" And just watching them all dodge around themselves to try to maintain that in some way, shape, or form this is relevant and not just a whole bunch of a theater was extraordinary. And you really got to give them credit for taking a question like that and deciding to roll with it for more than a few minutes. Cause yeah. God, what do you even say at that point? Right.
Yeah. My last, oh no, go ahead.
Yeah, no, it was, I mean, the whole thing was amazing. I should say, just to be complete in our survey of this, that there was a lot of stuff going on with Ron DeSantis's face. So do a Google or image search for that when you're done watching the episode.
No, the one thing I wanted to know is I know that Nikki Haley's like pre-canned line was like, "Every time I hear you, Vivek, I feel like I'm getting dumber," right? She said that kind of what you said about the whole debate. She said about just Vivek, but I'm curious if you remember what, because anything he said, including most of the things she says, except for like when she throws lip service to like, I think she said climate change is real or something.
She might have said that at one point. Like her big thing, I don't really remember from this debate. Like there was a whole incredibly weird exchange between her and Tim Scott, where he was trying to, I don't know why he was even attacking her. I mean, I'd be amazed if she had more than 5% of the vote.
He must just not like her personally.
Yeah, because he took down the Confederate flag. He's mad about that.
Well, so he did this whole weird attack on her for when she was UN ambassador, doing having expensive curtains that she was like wasting the taxpayers' money. And then she was like, no, those were Obama's curtains. You know, they were from the White House. He was like, well, you put them up.
Yeah, but again, that goes back to the earlier question. Like, what do you even talk about?
Right.
Everyone realizes this is so irrelevant that nothing that is said here is really going to matter whatsoever. At that point, you know, to our early conversation, Mandy, I might have just fucking like lit a blunt up and been like, fuck it, let's see where this goes, right?
Matt, I think it basically becomes Festivus, the Seinfeld episode, which is the airing of petty grievances, right? That's basically all it is.
It's too dark to do acid. You can't do acid.
Yeah, you can't do that.
No.
Oh, yeah.
I was wondering if Vivek—that's all Vivek is doing, because he's the only one who looks like he's having a good time there. Probably because he figures, like, well, if not this electoral cycle, you know, one or two or three or four down the line, right? He just basically looks like, I'm just gonna fucking sit here and, you know, troll and troll and troll and see how many campaign donations I can get.
Yeah, whatever. I did see. I think it was from his Michigan speech. I'm not sure, but Trump actually did. I mean, Trump nailed it. Like, he had a very apt description. He was like, I'm pretty sure they're all running for like whatever they can get in my administration, just whatever's available. I mean, vice president maybe, but do you see any vice presidents on that stage?
Yeah, and this is what I mean, right? Like, when I listened to Chris Christie do that whole Donald Duck line, I was like, you know, it's pretty good as a line, but you just can't compare it to the master, right? You know, Donald Trump would have killed that line and killed it so hard that nobody could ever look at Chris
Christie. Donald Trump actually has the force of personality to make that line funny.
Exactly, right? Like Christie, it's like you're going through the rhythm and the words are there, but the soul is just not, you know?
I think Trump has a good instinct of when something should be a throwaway line, which is just a stand-up comedian's instinct, you know what I mean? But, like, we're calling him Donald Duck. We're going to call him Donald Duck. Like, you know, like repeat it. And it's like, he's not throwing it out there as, like, this is my punchline. And if you don't laugh, like...
No, like, he would be in on the fact that part of the joke is how silly it is, but, like, you know, he would, like, repeat it until it was funny.
That's it.
Just how to thread the needle back to it. You know,
it's the way, like, Christie leaned in, looked really serious, and kind of smiled. Like, he's like, smart. Oh, I've got a killer line there. And you're like, it's not a killer line. Like, it's at best, like, a 6 out of 10, maybe. But
it did come back around to actually being killer, and 100% ironically is the funniest moment from my sense of humor. Not in the way he intended, I don't think.
But that's it. Yeah. Like, unintentionally, it became funny because you're just kind of like, it's a bit of the, it's kind of thing that, like, my dad or my granddad would have found funny. I would have thought, like, oh, that's a big sick burn, right?
Maybe during Donald Duck's, like, heyday. Like, when he first.
And, you know, no surprise, you know, the Republican Party is the one that's trading in that kind of humor. But you're right. Like, Donald Trump would have killed it because, like Ben said, sheer force of personality would have made it look utterly effortless. And everybody who looked at, like, Chris Christie from then on would have just seen Donald Duck or, you know, whatever it happens to be. And it would never
It would have started to be like, yeah, like, it would have actually been funny to call him Donald Duck. Like, that's yeah, I mean, whatever. I still like De Sanctimonious. I know that one got mixed reviews from the critics, but
it's grown on me, though. It has.
Yeah. I actually think Nikki Haley in some ways, yeah, I think she might have admitted at one point in one of the debates that climate change existed, and she's and in the first debate she said some stuff about how it's like politically impossible to have a federal abortion ban. So those were sort of her moments of lucidity. But she's like, yeah, it's, I mean, do you think we had the votes in the Senate? How would this work? You know, like,
but she's like a huge deficit hawk, right? Like,
huge deficit hawk.
Yeah. If she actually became president, I could see it being worse than.
I actually think in some ways she might be the worst person on the stage. I know that's a high bar, but, like, But beyond being a huge deficit hawk, she's a very huge actual hawk. Yes. Like she, like actually the one Vivek line that made me laugh on purpose for the first debate was when he told her, best of luck in your future career on the boards of Raytheon and Lockheed Martin.
yeah.
And yeah, she's, I think she's definitely one of the, you know, like a lot of, Republicans are like, okay, we can't really do, you know, if we're going to have a war with China, we probably need to like patch, you know, patch this thing up with Russia. We can't really do both. Nikki seems like a, we could do both kind of Republican. Like, no. We'll do a war with Russia and a war with China. It'll be fine.
Works so well in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
No, having two major fronts famously works really well in war, right?
No, it's like at the fucking party, right? You know, if you invite one person to a party, it'll be reasonably good, but it's not even really a party. Three people, you know, you're starting to get something, right? So just like how a party exponentially gets bigger, better, the more people are involved, so too does war, right? Just bring them all in.
Two's company, three's a party.
We'll air all our grievances at once, right? Get it all out of the way. Huge general war all across the globe, right? Let everybody get it out of their system. A couple million will die. It'll be good. It'll be healthy.
Yeah, we have the Einstein line about how we're supposedly the Einstein line about how you know, doesn't know what weapons World War III will be fought with, but World War IV will be sticks and stones.
Yeah, right back to the Stanley Kubrick, you know. I also got to say, I do think that it's a lot of fun that I'm old enough to remember when the conservative movement in the United States likes to pride itself on being non-utopian, you know, accepting limits and kind of thinking of itself as defined by prudent realism as opposed to extremism. Now, that was always bullshit, but at least they kind of maintained that rhetoric. It's really telling that Nikki Haley is so unpopular precisely because she's trying to tell so many people in the Republican Party what's impossible, and nobody fucking wants to hear that. They're like, no, if fucking 2 + 2 = 4 is a barrier, then you find a way to get us 5, okay? You find a way.
Well, speaking of expanding the horizons of the possible, the second best moment to my mind, other than Donald Duck, obviously, of the debate was Mike Pence's bold promise to repeal the Green New Deal. So we're finally getting rid of the Green New Deal.
About time.
Did Michael Pence say that he sleeps with his wife? I just saw that tweet.
He did. He said, so Chris Christie had done his like Jill Biden joke. I think Bhaskar said on Twitter, all of the Trumpian crassness, but like none of the charisma. And Mike Pence tried to riff off of it by saying like, you know, cause his wife's also a teacher, that, you know, that, that like, you know, I must admit I've also been sleeping with a teacher but she's not in the union.
I mean, Pence joining this was pretty fucking amazing though. I'm not going to lie. Cause I remember when he made his announcement for president, it was big to do about it. He posted on Twitter. The guy has like a millions of followers and 52 people liked it. Yes. I was just like, God damn, like some jackass with like followers.
It took like hours for it to get up to 52 likes.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, some person with like 100 followers that's named like Shitbird could easily get those numbers just by posting like just random TikTok videos about people doing dumbassery, right? And this is like the vice president of the United States, and nobody wants to hear this announcement.
I feel like before I got to actually ask you, Ben, what happened, it just reached me through these like hallucinatory fragments of like Mike Pence said he sleeps with his wife. Like, like Christie calls Trump Donald Duck, and they're all just disconnected. And now you're making them make sense. I don't know which is better.
It's probably better to get them disconnected. It's like, you know, my thing about The Departed, that the best way to take in that movie is by watching an hour and a half of YouTube videos. So you get all the good scenes and all the good lines, but you don't have to think about the plot.
That's just the weird moments that like clang out as opposed to any of like the actual substantive discussion. Not that there really was much.
Okay. So Mike Pence repealing the Green New Deal was the second best. The absolute best was Tim Scott, who promised to go further than just repealing the Green New Deal. He promised that, I swear I'm not making this up, this is an exact quote, he would restore capitalism.
Nice. We've been living without it for such a long time. Time to bring the hero back. That comeback we've all been looking for.
Yeah, I think I missed when the United States nationalized its means of production, but glad we're reversing that.
Well, it's like I said, one of the beautiful things about reading a lot of conservative literature is if all these people who talk about race Marxism and cultural Marxism and race cultural Marxism and Marxist Marxism are right, really the fucking Soviet Union won this Cold War hands down, and it wasn't even all that close. It's a very bizarre kind of world to live in, but boy, oh boy, is it kind of endearing in certain ways if you are a leftist.
Yeah. the other one, the other Jackman article was called Unions Are for Fighting the Boss, Don't Turn Them into Toothless Guilds. It is a response to a nationally syndicated op-ed by one Allison Schrager from the Manhattan Institute, who starts. I actually want to take a quick look at this. She says that. Yeah, too many tabs, man.
Allison Schrager from the Manhattan Institute definitely doesn't sound like an evil. Like an evil person. I don't know. Not to hate on anyone's name, but just that combo, Allison Schrager from the Manhattan Institute. I mean, it could kind of be a leftist too, like a super wonky leftist, but what is the Manhattan Institute, first of all?
I'm forgetting. Manhattan Institute is a think tank.
Okay.
And I looked it up.
Developing the bomb, right?
Yeah, exactly. They're doing a project. Yeah, it's a think tank. If you look up, it's very easy to Google this, Manhattan Institute funders, and you can look at all of the different foundations and whatnot that give them money. Is a lot of the Koch Family Foundation, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley. It is like all of the hits are there. And she has this op-ed. So it's from Bloomberg Opinion. I actually found out about it because a friend of mine from grad school had seen it like syndicated in his local newspaper in Minnesota. And so you see the deck there. There should be less about collective bargaining and more like guilds that offer various kinds of insurance. And so she starts out saying this: the labor movement is having a moment. In a tight employment market, there's money to be had, or profits to be more generously shared, and workers have gotten some big wins recently. Even reality TV stars and NFL running backs are getting into it. But this is not a revival of unions. In fact, unless they reform, it could be their last gasp. Oh, no. Yes, there have been more union drives and some undeniable successes. If you guys have ever watched the movie Donnie Brasco, there's a moment in Donnie Brasco. They're all like on the deck of like a yacht, and you know, without spoiling too much, there's a character from earlier in the movie who's about to be screwed over a little bit, and the conversation starts. Look, we all love this guy. I always think about that scene when I read, like, you know, the op-ed that has the artfully packing, you know, like, okay, let's get this out of the way in the first couple paragraphs. Here's all the evidence against my thesis. Well, anyway,
what would be the leftist version of that? Maybe we could ponder on that. Like, we're about to just completely trash something. Maybe if I wrote something about like Elizabeth Warren or something, I'd be like, you know, we all love Elizabeth Warren, but you know,
hey, that's my senator.
Yeah.
Watch out.
It's something you have to be able to at least give lip service to. I don't know. Maybe we all like Jordan Peterson's fashion sense, but you know,
we all enjoy his suits. There's no denying that it's good to clean your room.
Yeah.
I mean, I read his poetry every single day just for a little bit of inspiration. Right. And you'll be surprised at how far I can take you. Like, there are days where I just read it and I'm like, fuck yeah. You know, time to go crusade against those old warriors.
But Ben, you're right. Saying like, you know what, sometimes maybe you should clean your room. That is the version of when you're about to say the meanest thing you've ever said about anyone. All right, let's. Yeah.
Um, But this is not a revival of unions. In fact, there's public support for a possible UAW strike this week. So this is a couple weeks old for unions in general. If you ask working Americans, however, most of them, about two-thirds of them, according to 2022 Gallup poll, don't want to actually be in a union. So I looked this up. She's inflating the number a little bit, even from the Gallup poll. That one says it's 58-42. Non-union workers don't want to join a union. There's also a big one from a few years back that says it's at least half do want to join. I think, you know, that other number you see a lot from a few years ago, I think it's very plausible it's more than that now. But in any case, hold that thought. This explains, she says, why many union drives fail. So, Jake, having the most firsthand experience, if anybody here with this, do you think that's the most plausible explanation of why, you know, why so many union drives fail, that people just don't want to join?
Well, no, but I was thinking there's two different types of union drives failing, right? One in which I guess, I mean, I don't even know. I mean, a lot of them is after the point at which a majority of the union workers have said they want to join a union. So these are workers that already wanted to, and then are subjected, you know, basically to psychological warfare from experts whose only job it is to be psychological soldiers, right, and playing good cop, bad cop, and convincing you not to join. So, you know, even then, many succeed is actually maybe the more interesting question, right? Than how many fail, you know?
Yeah. That's, what was that famous thing not too long ago? Like, why would you want to join a union when you could take all those dues, you could buy yourself a fucking Xbox?
yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's a compelling argument. I want an Xbox. Fuck.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this is like the Simpsons, you know, it's the $20. I wanted a peanut. $20 to buy many peanuts.
Yeah. But no, but as you know, and I know you're sort of joking, but the arguments they make are actually way more sophisticated than the Xbox article. I mean, that Xbox, that was like a billboard, I think they had, or not a bill, like a poster they had up during, like, I think a flight attendant.
Which is also in the bathroom of all things. So it's like, great, I can go to the washroom and just have anti-union propaganda staring at me the whole fucking time and just think like, God, how did I end up here in my life?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, but the way they do it is actually very sophisticated, where they don't even convince people necessarily like unions are bad. They convince people that like all of this pressure that you are feeling right now, it's because you're unionizing. Is it really worth it? You know, you could maybe lose your job. Maybe we could close down. You know, we could close down the store, this firm, right? Like, I mean, they're not allowed to say that, but they can kind of imply it. And they basically, anyway, you opened up a sore spot, Ben, from
the yeah, well, right. So this is the point I made in the article that, that, you know, like, look, let's take her number. I think she's cherry picking, the poll result that has the closest to what she said, although, you know, I mean, not to be too pedantic about this, but, you know, 58 is still 8 less than 66. But in any case, but let's just assume for the sake of argument her extremely dubious number. Okay, well, 100 minus 58 would be 42. If 42% of non-unionized workers join unions, that would quadruple union density in the United States. And that would be an earthquake.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So you need to, I think you're going to
be the highest union density in the whole country's fucking history. And it wouldn't even be very close.
Yeah, exactly.
What's Norway's union density? I'm going to look that up right now. Yeah,
varies between about 60 to 70%. So we wouldn't be quite at that peak, but it would be
We wouldn't be at Norway yet, but we would be most of the way there. We would be a hell of a lot be so dramatically closer. So it looks like you need a second explanation, and you know, a real difference. I don't know a lot about Norwegian labor law, so you know, somebody else would have to fill that in, but certainly between the United States and a lot of other countries is that we have just spectacularly awful labor laws in the US. So as Jake alludes to, just having the majority of the workforce sign union cards is not enough to get union recognition. You still have to have an election where in the lead up to the election, this is one of the things the PRO Act was going to ban. You have, you know, if that happened, like the Green New Deal, that isn't actually law. That you have, the employer can force people to go to what are called captive audience meetings, while you're, during your work hours, where you're subjected to anti-union propaganda. And as Jake says, often extremely thinly veiled threats, that the place will close. You know, it's, you know, the way you put it, you know, you can't say, hey, if you do this, we're going to close. You have to say, well, I mean, who knows? I mean, maybe company won't be able to afford that. I mean, it's possible. And
when they don't actually, that's when they don't just fucking say it. Cause sometimes they do. And then they're just, you know, like when Starbucks started to get desperate, they start actually firing people and threatening, I think. And I mean, some people who were fired literally got their job back through the NLRB. So when they get desperate, they take off that thin veneer too. So that's important to remember.
It's also beautiful to just see how much like the logic of an abuser this is. I mean, it's right back to like fucking that person who's just like beating the crap out of you and be like, why are you making me do this to you? Right? Like, don't you care enough about us maintaining our beautiful collegial relationship not to force me to do these things to you? Right? I mean, this is on you for just being unreasonable, right?
Yeah. Yeah. For exactly.
Yeah. So this is, yeah. I mean, so when the letter of the law is being followed, you can still have captive audience meetings. Union representatives don't have any right to show up, never mind make a countercase. You can still have thinly veiled threats. It has to be explicit to violate the letter of the law. You have no particular guarantee that union organizers can talk to people. If miraculously at the end of this process, you do actually succeed in organizing, and people stick with it. And, you know, the analogy I use in the articles, this is a little bit like if, you know, in the lead up to the 2024 election, Joe Biden could legally require all American voters to go to meetings where no Republicans had speaking time and they got to hear all about Biden's accomplishments. And he dropped a few hints that he might have to blow up the country if Trump won again to stop him from assuming office. So, you know, if you think that would be reasonable, right, you know, that's the approximate equivalent.
Not to mention, let's add, like, the Supreme Court might just very well rule that, yeah, you can have this union, but you can't require its members to pay union dues, right, out of the Jones decision in 2018. So you'll just have to find a way to organize and collectively bargain while also not having any kind of internal revenue stream. So good luck with that, guys.
Yeah, and of course, and then when you do, if you do miraculously succeed in organizing, and the company stonewalls you in negotiations and you go out and strike, American labor law from the late 1940s is almost uniquely awful about this. You can't be fired, but you can be permanently replaced. You know, it's a subtle distinction, you know, for going on strike. If it's not retaliatory, they just want to keep things going, and who knows, maybe in the future they'll have a new opening. That, you know, and you can come back. And of course, as we've just seen with the WGA and SAG, you can't have sympathy strikes. It would be, even though it's all the same big workplace, essentially, because they're different unions, it would be illegal, for example, for the writers to stay out until the actors' demands are met. That couldn't be a legally sanctioned strike. So I'd say that, you know, the remarkable thing is not that many fail under this. And, you know, as Jake very rightly says, this is when the letter of the law has been followed. In reality, of course, in real life, it's very often not followed. And the NLRB is, you know, severely underfunded. And, you know, so in the Starbucks case, for example, more than 200 Starbucks Workers United members were fired in what the union says is illegal retaliation. For union activities, a couple dozen of them were reinstated so far. But you know, it's not like you know, it's not like existing labor law even includes all that much in the way of penalties when this stuff happens. You know, like, don't expect to see, you know, Howard Schultz or whoever the new one is at Starbucks to be, you know, perp walked in handcuffs for the many violations of labor law. You know, by and large, you're just kind of slapped on the wrist. Maybe you'll get a big fine. But, you know, don't count on that. So, like, all told, the thing that seems remarkable to me in this environment is that so many organizing drives succeed. And in fact, that you get stuff like the Writers Guild just took on not only the sort of big traditional Hollywood studios, but also some of the biggest corporations on the planet. You know, I mean, like Apple, for example, is a streamer now, so they're on that side of the negotiating table.
And I'd like to add, if you didn't already have enough reason to support the writer's strike, Ron Perlman gave what I think is probably the most epic fucking speech about this I've ever heard in my entire life, where he just stood there and called out all the Hollywood bullshit that came. And that speech alone, and the fact that it will go down in history, was worth everything, both leading up to the writing strike and after it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, Ron Perlman.
And somehow he made Donald Duck work.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's sorry.
Just
but.
Got an amazing contract, and right now it looks to me like, you know, we'll see what happens, right? But you know, I'm optimistic about the UAW, and you know, I know there are some. I don't know. I see a lot of backseat driving on that, but I think so. You know, so far it looks good to me.
I was there last week, and I got to say, I've never seen this kind of outpouring of support. Now, I know Michigan is a very union state, right? But there are some fucking points where I couldn't even hear people talk because we'd be holding picket signs, and there were so many cars honking solidarity at us that everybody just had to be quiet and kind of bask in it, right? So, I mean, that's a really good sign to me that the public seems overwhelmingly, certainly in the state, to be supportive of what's going on.
Yeah, there's polling evidence for that too. But there's something like 75% of Americans said they support the strike. You wouldn't know it. It's a Republican debate. So, it's, you know, I think if somebody from a billionaire funded think tank comes along and says, oh, I've got some great advice to you for you, this is really going to help you out. You should stop asking for so much. You know, I don't know, maybe think twice about taking it.
Yeah. I think the last thing I wanted to say on it, just on the idea of like how do union drives win or how do so many of them win? You know, there's that quote of like, how can you not be romantic about baseball? You know, I feel like about if you've seen a union drive that wins, I'm like, how can you not be romantic about unions? I think it really fucking feels. I mean, and we have to be clear headed about these things and not and not just get caught up in some kind of idealism or romanticism. But I'm just saying, if you're looking for evidence of like, you know, the human spirit really prevailing, that is the most beautiful one of the, like, you know, really just like everyday people prevailing against, like, you know, millions and millions of dollars worth of money that's trying to convince them to go against their, you know, psychologically trick them into going against their worst interests, going against their best interests, and seeing them actually prevail is like one of the most inspiring things you could see. So it's very, very disgusting to see this think tank funded ghoul state otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, last thing I want to hit before we start, before see you say goodbye to you guys before the post game and talk to Matt about his book, well, we have a clip for this, but let me just set up the clip by asking it this way. Matt, you're not from this country.
I am not, you know. Fucking from the true north, strong and proud, baby.
Yeah. Well, we have a clip to go with this question, but the fuck is going on in Canada?
Well, to hear right-wing media talk about it, we're under the control of a communist dictatorship. that's about to seep its tendrils outwards and just destroy the American way of life, the British way of life, just everything and everywhere's way of life will be just crushed under the
chronic
grip of feudalism.
Sure. So far, you know, that's pretty standard. But something else strange happened in Canada. Jake, this is the clip just before the bottom.
Zelensky's speech received at least a dozen standing ovations. There was also one for this man, a 98-year-old Ukrainian-Canadian who fought for Ukrainian independence against the Russians during the Second World War.
Now, I don't know what kind of school system you have in Canada, like what their history classes are like, but when you hear that somebody fought against the Russians in the Second World War, I really think that, you know, members of parliament should be able to put it together that like which the sides were in World War II and how that lined up.
You think so? I mean, the interesting thing is this was doubly disappointing for me, both because it was embarrassing and also personally because my dad's job when I was younger was literally finding people who were members of the Nazi Party who had fled to Canada after the Second World War. And try to integrate into society, right? And not even normal Nazis, like really, really bad Nazis, right? And, you know, they did everything. They, you know, posed as butchers. They posed as, you know, mechanics. You know, they were all throughout society, right? And Canada got pretty good at finding these people and extraditing them to be tried in any number of different countries where they had committed crimes. So you'd think that before they brought somebody into the House of Commons to applaud them, somebody might have chosen to take a pass on this.
I believe that actually after that clip and everybody pointed out the obvious about fighting against the Russians in World War II and what that must have meant, and then people figured out who exactly guy had fought for. Yes, Matt's dad was ultra-based. We agree. After this, I believe that the Polish government actually announced that they were starting, legal proceedings to look into this dude.
I know. Yeah.
Fucking play the Curb Your Enthusiasm music for that guy. he all he had to do was just not, you know,
just keep his fucking head down. Yeah.
He was almost at the finish line too. Cause he looks,
he's 98 years old, right?
I guess he's like, fuck it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he figured that he didn't have anything left to lose at that point. But yeah, and I mean, it's not even like this is an idiosyncratic fact either. I mean, it's well known that many Ukrainians signed up to fight with the SS and the Wehrmacht, right, to agitate for any kinds of Russian, like Ukrainian independence. Most of these were right-wing Ukrainians who didn't have much fondness for Soviet communism to begin with, right? And then that's to say nothing about the association between what was going on then and what's going on now. They're entirely different conflicts. But
sure, of course,
this is well known to historians. And the fact that nobody could have thought that this might be a possibility is baffling to me. But, you know,
yeah,
it's not the dumbest thing that's ever happened on the floor of the House of Commons. So at least maybe that's a somewhat exonerating
factor. All right. Well, I want to hear the if you have like a top five list or something of the dumbest.
Our first prime minister, literally the founding father of our nation, was a famous opium addict and drunk. And he was once so hungover in the House of Commons that when the opposition was giving a speech, he just vomited all over the floor and had to be carried out. So that's our George Washington.
That's the appropriate response to some speeches that politicians make is just vomiting all over the floor. So
correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't he like get drunk and like set himself on fire by accident?
I never heard of John A. doing that, but it wouldn't shock me, right? Because the guy had a lot of vices, right? He was somebody who picked them up enthusiastically and didn't let them go. He held on to them tight.
Yeah, no, I learned that from a song where one of the verses is like, you know, he woke up, his desk was on fire, his hair was on fire, he was on fire.
Andy is an expert on guys that have just lit themselves on fire throughout history.
I feel like I'm working on a book, you know, for my book.
Yeah, that's funny.
It's a coffee table book.
self-immolators. Self-immolators, yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of amazing, you know, Matt, that you mentioned, you know, the current war, because I do think this is a little bit complicated and, you know, like it takes more than 10 seconds to explain, so most people tune out, you know, by the time you get to it. But like, a couple of different things are all true here. That there is a you know, far right in Ukraine. That's like a real force, and you know, and they have their, you know, armed forces, and they're extremely scary. And before 2022, the Western press used to regularly write articles about, you know, how bad and scary these guys were. True. Also true. You know, Putin trying to like pretend that that's why he invaded, like makes weapons of mass destruction look good. It's like extremely silly. That has nothing to do with it. And you know, if you want evidence of that, you know, Putin himself has been more than willing to work with very similar forces, right? That's, So like clearly he's not in Ukraine to like try to denazify Ukraine. That's stupid. It is a little weird that since February 2022, Western press has done a total reversal, and like now it's not okay to talk about, you know, the Azov stuff and all that. But putting all that aside, look, the word Nazi is really overused. You know, people bring up Nazi analogies at the drop of a hat. You know who is exactly like the Nazis? The Nazis.
Yeah. Call members of the SS who participated in the Holocaust, you know. Yeah, it's just baffling to me, right?
Yeah. Do we have the Politico article about this? So I just saw this was making its rounds today. It should be. There we go. Fighting against the USSR didn't necessarily make you a Nazi. Now, the context, just to really make sure everybody's clear on this, is that I suppose he could, you know, I mean, I think it would depend which war you fought the USSR in. If it was World War II, that really raises the chance that you were a Nazi. But also what raises it to 100% is if the particular armed force in which you enrolled to fight the USSR was the Waffen-SS.
Yeah.
That's, you know, this is like, I you know.
Oh, no.
I really thought it was uncontroversial that the Waffen-SS was really bad.
You think so, right? But everything needs to be reevaluated at this point. But I think Sam Moyne had the right take on this personally. Now, I want to make it clear. I am not a Russia apologist, right? I don't think Russian imperialism is commendatory in any way, shape, or form. I also acknowledge that, you know, the Ukraine regime was deeply flawed, and there were a lot of ultra-right elements in it that were, as you put it, very, very scary. I think Moyne's point, though, about the Western response to this is the war in Ukraine really gave Cold War liberalism, his term, a kind of shot in the arm, a major shot in the arm, because then they were able to say, oh, look, it's the old enemy again, Russia. They're back to their old tricks. So what we need to do is fight the good fight, declare Ukraine a completely stable, wonderful liberal democracy, and then give them as much aid as we possibly can, short of actually sending troops into the ground. And it'll be yet another struggle where we come out on top and vindicate the kind of mid-liberal consensus that Cold War liberals are so keen to uphold. And it doesn't surprise me that in their desperation to kind of make Cold War liberalism a thing again, right? Contra like Regina George's, you know, entire thing, like stop making Cold War liberalism try to happen again. It's done. It's over, right? Never going to happen again. So, you know, in their desperation, I guess they just started searching really hard. They found this guy and they're like, let's throw him up there. And boy, oh boy, is it embarrassing and kind of funny.
Yeah. So I want to just briefly look at this because this is incredible, right? So the Politico article says here we go. Yeah, fighting against the USSR didn't necessarily make you a Nazi. That's the history is in the case of Hunke, the mass outrage stems from his enlistment with one of the foreign legions of the Waffen-SS, fighting the Soviet forces on Germany's Eastern Front, is a demonstration of how when history is complicated, so complicated, it can be a gift to propagandists who exploit the appeal of simplicity. The history is complicated because fighting against the USSR at the time didn't necessarily make you a Nazi, just somebody who had an excruciating choice over which of these two terror regimes. So moral equivalence between the USSR and the Nazis. That's fun. To resist. However, the idea that foreign volunteers and conscripts, well, wasn't a conscript, were being allocated to the Waffen-SS rather than the Wehrmacht, administrated rather than ideological grounds. You have to take a personal oath of loyalty to Adolf Hitler to be in the SS. is a hard sell for audiences. It's a hard sell. Conditioned. I love this. It's a hard sell for audiences. Conditioned to believe the SS's primary task was genocide. I mean, we did so many other things in the Waffen-SS. People only remember the genocide. Do they remember like the dance parties, the pizza? No,
just the real sense of camaraderie that you had with your brothers. You know, there's almost like a little community spirit that was involved in it. Why can't people talk about those good things?
The Bratfest was just amazing.
Yeah. And I mean, what's so repellent about this also is there have been historians, including apologists for Nazism, that have poured over this and poured over this and poured over this. And it is very difficult to find a single instance, somebody within the Waffen-SS or any of the terror units in the Nazi regime who was ever prosecuted or persecuted in a serious way for refusing to follow a terrible order, right? Like exterminating a family or, you know, sending people to die in one of the death camps. So these people made a clear choice that they were in a bad situation and there was a way to make it better. One of the ways to make it better was participate in a terror machine. And I have no sympathy whatsoever for the claim that, well, history compelled them or circumstances compelled them to do these terrible things.
Like, I mean, the like, it blows my mind because, like, okay, you know, I think that I'm very skeptical that protracting the war in Ukraine for years and years more is going to do anything but like adjust where the ceasefire line in the Donbass ends up being. I would like de-escalation and peace negotiations. That's my position. But fuck it. Say I'm wrong. Right? Say that the right view is that, you know, no compromise, no inch, you know, like, you know, keep fighting to the last drop of everybody's blood. Fine. How is this helping the Ukrainians to, like, I mean, this is like, really, the line should be, hey, you know what this guy was part of? An occupying army in Ukraine. Like, an invading occupying force. And so really the equivalents of Ukraine now, here's how you make the argument, are the people who are fighting off the occupy, you know, like, people, you know, in the Red Army who are fighting off the invading force, which, by the way, the Red Army in World War II was not just Russians. It was, you know, the USSR was a multinational state. There were tons of Ukrainians in the Red Army. And if you were in the Waffen-SS, there's a the chances that you were committing some atrocities against Ukrainians are right around 100.
And I also want to add, I think that part of the reason for this is really that, especially in the West, the role the USSR played in defeating Nazism has been profoundly underplayed. Nathan Robinson wrote a really good piece about this a couple years ago, right, where he pointed out he went to a World War II museum and there's almost nothing about the Eastern Front on it, right? Let's really be clear here. About 70 to 80% of Axis forces were concentrated on the Eastern Front post-1941, right? Sometimes it could even escalate higher. So the reality is that as important a role as the Western Allies played in defeating Nazism, and we did play a very important role, and I'm not understating the sacrifice of it, we gave an assist to the Soviet Union on that front, right? Not the other way around. And once you appreciate that the war against Germany, not the war against Japan, really has to be understood as focus on the Soviet-German conflict, really it recontextualizes an awful lot. And it should also make you aware of the extraordinary sacrifice that the Russians paid in order to defeat Nazism. I mean, 20 million dead is larger than every single Western ally combined, right? Including all the small countries that were occupied for a long period of time. And that's not to diminish our sacrifice or their sacrifice, right? It's just to really give people a sense of the scope of what went on here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that includes millions of Ukrainians, right, who fought and died to end the occupation.
Of course, yeah. And, like, I don't know. I just, you know, I really did not think this was going to be controversial in 2023. But, you know, I think that if there's one thing that I thought we had consensus on civilizationally, it was which the right side of World War II was. So, yeah. You know, let's hold on to that. That's my last thought about that. Jake, Andy, I will see you guys in the post game with David Griscom. I want to talk now about this book. a how-to guide to cosmopolitan socialism, a tribute to Michael Brooks. This book was a very long time coming, which to do my necessary mea culpa is 100% my fault. That this
pandemic
is
pandemic played a role also, Ben. Don't worry too much. I had long hair back then, though. It's funny.
Yeah, pandemic. Okay, maybe 5% the pandemic, 95% me. I wrote the introduction to this book, and when you asked me if I'm remembering correctly, this was summer of 2021. So it was like, you know, you got in, you know, I think you'd written a draft of the book at that point. And you asked me if I'd write an introduction where I talked about, Michael and his views and my friendship with him and all that stuff. And I said, sure, I'll do that. And honestly, I didn't, you know, think it was going to be that hard to do because I had, you know, the summer before, in the weeks after he died, I actually wrote two different articles about him, What Michael Brooks Meant to Me, which is the more personal one, and The Cosmopolitan Socialism of Michael Brooks, about his politics. And both of those were pretty easy to write. And what I quickly found when I tried to write this is that the difference a year makes is that it was... Yeah. It was damn near impossible to force myself to write anything about Michael. And it was like December of 2021. I finally like forced myself to sit down. I remember that was a trip to California, you know, one of the ones before I, lived here. I remember sitting at a coffee shop in LA and spending like hours, you know, writing part of an introduction to it, and I hated it, and I threw it out, and like it was like several, like by the time I turned it in, it was like a year since you asked. So so that is on me, but I am really happy that it is out now. You know, anybody who you know, if you order this book, there's a Red Emma's link in the description for the episode. For better or for worse, those first 13 pages, you know, the introduction, are probably the hardest 13 pages I've ever had to write of anything ever that I can think of. So
it's the best part of the book. So I mean, all that thought and all that reflection, all that time, really, I don't say paid off, as that's too crass, but sure, you definitely feel it when you read it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it is definitely a more, I think it's definitely the most complete thing of, you know, I've written about that. You know, there's like, you know, stuff that was left out is largely stuff that's going to have to wait until I can, I don't know, if I write a memoir in 50 years or something, when enough principals are dead, then I'll include
giving myself an argument, a life and analysis.
Yeah. But otherwise this is the closest to that anybody's getting right now. But the book itself, you know, one of the things, I said in the introduction, I don't really envy the task you had in writing this, because, you know, one of the things that really struck me when I was thinking about this is that, you know, Michael Brooks was one of the best verbal communicators in the history of the modern left. He had a real talent for making connections between ideas in conversation or on air in a way that just kind of vividly got you to see where he was going with it. But that's just a very different thing from actually sitting down and trying to, like, you know, trying to pry it apart and be like, okay, well, what exactly is the, you know, is the idea here? And there's like a tremendous amount of translation to go from one to the other. I mean, this is, you know, this is like, I mean, whatever, I'm in awe of how good he was at that, you know, conversationally, yeah. But it's just a, you know, it's just a very different activity. So, you know, I mean, I think you're very upfront in saying that this is, you know, like, look, this is you know, this is a book by Matt McManus. This is what you got out of it, you know, but but I think it's really important work that somebody does. And I'm really happy that you, you know, kind of kicked off the project of doing it, because I mean, this, again, this is kind of what I was complaining about earlier, about the sort of flattening of a lot of what made him interest in, you know, recollect, you know, popular recollection of him, that, you know, these ideas were really important to him. Like he spent, like I, you know, so Michael's book Against the Web, I tell this whole story in the introduction. I spent, you know, I worked with him very closely on writing it, which is basically a process where over the course of months, you know, I had many, many like in-depth conversations that I, you know, sort of compare in the introduction to, you know, a director when somebody's, you know, getting ready to shoot some footage for the movie, saying exactly what he wants for every shot and, you know, and everything. And then, you know, the actual process, you know, like, you know, spend like some days in his apartment in Brooklyn, you know, from like breakfast through like the middle of the night, basically, you know, working and reworking, you know, some of these passages with him. And I know that the most important part of that book to him was the last part, which was the vision of cosmopolitan socialism, which is obviously what you're focused on in this book. And so I mean, I can speak to some of what I, you know, I know he expressed, you know, to me that, you know, he found important to that, but, you know, but the, this is really like, you know, you've produced something that it's like, look, I mean, it's clearly for, you know, this is a very accessible book, but it's, you know, but it's like a, it's an academically rigorous, like, you know, you're, it's a exploration of ideas. So, I mean, what is that, you know, like, what does that phrase mean to you? Cosmopolitan socialism?
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, there are a couple of things I wanted to say about this, which is, first off, like you said, this is a book written by me, not written by Michael. And I'm not saying that to try to be jealous at all. I'm just saying it because Michael was irreplaceable, right? I can't write like he can. I certainly can't, you know, express like he could. It was an extraordinary talent, right? So really all I was doing was the best I could to try to pay tribute to that legacy and try to unpack some of the ideas that he laid out in Against the Web and a bunch of different speeches and, you know, our own conversations and your conversations while, you know, filling in some of the gaps. So I think, you know, the book stands on its own and it tries to do this. And I think that people who loved Michael Brooks will probably get something from it in that respect. But I want to make it clear, right, that he was an irreplaceable guy and this book is a tribute to him at best, right? The next thing that I wanted to say that was that to try to really fill in some of the gaps in what he was talking about, there were two steps that I took. The first one is really taking very seriously a lot of the interests and different figures that he and I actually shared. So Michael was a big fan of Amartya Sen and Cornel West. So am I, right? I find them very inspiring figures. And they really added a lot of the meat to the bones of what Michael understood by cosmopolitan socialism. This notion that we need to look at the particularities of people's material existence and try to figure out how to help them. And this is very different depending upon the context, right? But that doesn't mean that we can't be global in our aspirations and recognize the common humanity that unites us all as needy and social creatures, right? And I think that what drew Michael to people like Cornel West and Amartya Sen above all was that Sen and West really demonstrate this kind of cosmopolitan empathy for people, right? That wherever you are, whoever you happen to be in the world, if you are in pain or there's something bad going on in your life, these people will insist that we have a duty to do something about it, right? So that leads to the second thing that I really tried to bring to this book, was that Michael unrelentingly stressed this need to be warm, compassionate. I mean, his signature line was, you know, hard on systems, kind to people, right? And so I really tried to adopt that approach when writing the book. You know, anybody who reads me knows that I can be a jerk, especially, you know, if you're a lazy conservative pundit.
Let's also be real clear on this. Like when Michael said that, you know, be ruthless to systems and kind to people. That was definitely him expressing a side of him and expressing something he cared about, you know, a lot. And, you know, and he was definitely trying to communicate something real, but also, I mean, come on, like on air and God knows off air, the man could be a world-class hilarious hater. It's complicated, but yeah, so it's not, you know, I mean, I don't want anybody remembering a Saint Michael here, because that's much less interesting than the person. But yeah, I mean, I think that the larger point is, like, as much as he you know could enjoy that, was very good at it.
I mean, his impressions of people like Ruben or Peterson were priceless, right? He's the real master at capturing. I can only describe it as, like, the essence of who these people were at their worst.
Really funny. Yeah, absolutely. And off air, I mean, he did impressions of a lot of other people too. I guess I won't say any, you know, that are going to get anybody who's likely to listen mad. So I'll just say the one, since this was already in Bhaskar's obituary of Michael, that, you know, he did this one of Bhaskar Sankara's parents. Yeah. Is there's, like, you know, sort of over the top Indian accents, very concerned that their son was, you know, founding a communist magazine instead of, like, becoming a doctor, a lawyer, and making some money. That's like that gives you, like, just a little bit of a flavor. I mean, there's a lot of you know, this is something I actually about not long after you asked me to do this, actually, I went to this memorial service that ended up being both for Michael, as, like, kind of a sort of for people who weren't able to go to the original one because of COVID, and also it ended up being for his dad, who died just before it was going to happen. And you know, originally it was, like, felt a little bit weird because I didn't know his dad, you know, that it was, like, this kind of half of what it was. But I'm really glad that I did. One of the reasons is that I felt like I got some insight into the guy, that he, like, one of the things that stuck in my head is that one of the speakers who was talking about his dad said apparently Michael's dad was just constantly going through life doing impressions of everybody he knew.
Yeah, I picked up on it. And yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I meant by the sense of empathy, actually, right? I didn't mean to say that he was Saint Michael or something, and that, you know,
sure, if
you read books, they're solemn affairs. If you listen to him speak, you know, you really felt morally stirred in the way that you would going to church. He was really just a wonderful person to talk to. And I only got to chat with him once on air, although we corresponded and we were always hoping to maybe do something together before he sadly passed. And what really stuck out to me about the guy was both how funny he was, but also how he really felt like he was listening to you and was interested in learning about you as a person. Like, I was only supposed to be interviewing him about Against the Web for Zero Books, but he almost didn't seem interested in talking about it, right? He was asking me my opinion about things. He wanted to learn a little bit about what made my interest in the book. He asked me questions about the book and what stuck out for me, right? He was a really other-centered guy, which I think is really at the root of a lot of his philosophy.
Totally. So
I wanted to bring a level of that warmth to the book, which is why, as you mentioned, it's definitely more of an academic-y text than it would have been certainly if he had written it, right? Trying to bring that level.
I mean, there is, like, a lot of, you know, there's, yeah, I think you feel a lot of that warmth and compassion in Against the Web. And even, you know, even with his sort of punching bags, like, one of the things I think people often miss when they're thinking about him is that, look, I mean, he was obviously interested in and very good at, like, making fun of, like, Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris and all these people, but he's actually also really interested in understanding what they were saying and in, like, sort of trying to see exactly what was wrong with what they were saying. I mean, the you know, segment I used to do on a show, the debunk, was entirely his idea. If you go back, if you go back and listen to, well, I mean, you know, even if you read the chapters of Against the Web, where he's going through these IDW figures, like, you know, I think you can tell that he spent a lot of time thinking about them. I mean, this is a thoughtful guy. He doesn't just want to dunk on them, that too, right? But he wants to like understand exactly what they're saying and sort of figure out exactly what's wrong with what they're saying and ultimately use it as this foil to set up like, okay, you know, here's what not to do, but like, what do we want? Right. What's the positive vision? And, you know, and I think with cosmopolitan socialism, it's like, I think there's a certain sense that he had, like he would sort of, what he would kind of jokingly refer to, obviously given the phrase, but like he was serious about the idea as like a third way in the culture war, yeah. By which he meant like, you know, Michael was a huge fan of people, you know, either like Adolf Reeds and Cedric Johnson's and people like that who really wanted to focus on material issues. But I mean, he also did get that you can't just tell people not to sort of care about culture or not to, you know, think about it because it's, you know, where people spend so much of their lives. What you do need is like some sort of reasonable way we can calm all of that down and kind of live together. And you know, I think this is where a lot of the cosmopolitanism comes in. That,
yeah.
You know, that it's in that sort of real, like, literal sense about, you know, like the way that people, different kinds of people mingle together in cities and, you know, travel around and all that stuff. That, you know, he hated the idea of cultural appropriation, you know, that like he thought that was just horrendous bullshit. It's like, look, everybody, every culture is equally available, you know, like everything is equally available to everybody. Yeah. Nobody's, you don't have to have some sort of like blood and soil connection to something. Like everybody should just, you know, everybody should just be like sort of accessing everything on equal terms. And, you know, and also something you talk a lot about in the book, is internationalism, which isn't quite a synonym there, which is why he did end up deciding to sort of stick with the cosmopolitan adjective, but is certainly like an important, you know, element in this mixture.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I want to say two things about what you mentioned, which is that I think that his willingness and interest in offering substantive critiques of people like, you know, Ben Shapiro or Jordan Peterson really, again, comes from this deep-rooted empathy, right? Where he didn't just want to do what Peterson or Shapiro themselves would do, which is to just dismiss the opposition and not even bother learning about them. He was really keen in understanding what made these guys tick, trying to understand the motivations behind their viewpoints. And I think that really demonstrates fundamentally this very cosmopolitan attitude, because at the root of cosmopolitan, from, you know, the Greek word cosmopolis, is this belief that you are a citizen of the world, or that nothing human is foreign to you, as the saying once good. And this is a kind of universalistic curiosity and engagement with humanity wherever it is that you happen to find it, right? And I think that you really see this demonstrated in the breadth and array of his issues, because Michael was engaged by so much, right? Which is, again, why it's such a tragedy that he's gone, because God only knows what would have happened if he was able to connect this all in writing, right? You know, Cornel West and cosmopolitan politics and Marxism and socialism and Taoism and spirituality, right? He was able to make it all feel so seamless, precisely because he really was the citizen of the world and didn't look upon anything human as being foreign to him the way that so many of us do. And I think one of the things that I really tried to foreground in the book was precisely this third way approach that he took to the endless battles between should we be, you know, materialists who are really focused on, you know, good, hard Marxist analysis, or should we commit it to identity politics? So there's a section in the book on what David Harvey calls militant particularism, which is basically just identity politics. And I tried to cut out a lot of the chatter. And I really thought, what would Michael say in these circumstances? And what I stress is that, look, there definitely was a problem with some elements of classical socialism that ignored the way that women were discriminated or tended to dismiss the struggle for racial equality by suggesting that, well, when we move to a classless society, that will all disappear. Sadly, even really heroic people like Eugene Debs could fall into this temptation, right? Gary Dorian talks about this very nicely in his new book on the history of democratic socialism in the United States. And Michael always empathized with this and wanted to make sure that any socialism that we had was inclusive and did take these kinds of struggles seriously. Nobody was better than him recognizing how a certain kind of woke identity politics could really easily be co-opted by capitalism and turned into really a kind of faux moralism, a very superficial defense of neoliberal individualism and neoliberal elitism evenly. And you saw that very nicely in the clip that we watched before this began, right? Where he talks about how if you're a disappointed, alienated white dude between 25 and 35, and you go and watch one of these centrist websites or go onto one of these centrist websites and are just told about how everything sucks and how you need to feel guilty about things, and how if you feel that something's going on in your life, then you should check going wrong in your life. You should check your privilege and not do anything about it. Michael always saw that as being deeply unempathetic and constituted a failure to recognize that people all around the globe, regardless of their background, are exploited and suffer under neoliberal conditions, which is why we need that materialist analysis. And we can't just do identity politics the whole way. So what would have happened if he had had his own opportunity to kind of establish this third way? I'm not sure, right? But I really think that his emphasis on people like West and Sen is indicatory. And it's why I tried to build on people like that to put flesh on the bones for the rest of the book.
Yeah, I mean, with the Sen part of it, you know, my sense was that a couple things were going on there. You know, one is certainly objecting to, you know, what you're calling following Harvey militant particularism. There's this stuff in the book where he talks about C.L.R. James's view that, like, it shouldn't be strange as him, you know, as like a subject of, you know, somebody from a former colony to like love British literature, because this is like the common inheritance of the human race and all that. I think there's also this like thread that's been, you know, needle that's been threaded that, in other words, okay, on the one hand, you know, you talk about this in the book that, you know, he wants to avoid sort of Western chauvinism dressed up as universal values. You know, that's like, you know, you don't want to say that, like, you know, quote unquote Western culture. And he appropriately makes fun of that phrase, given all of its, you know, what we would now think of as non-Western components and influences. I mean, nobody, you know, if you told Plato or Aristotle that they had more in common with, you know, barbarians in Scotland than they did with like Egyptians, they would have thought that was very funny. But in any case, that's like, you know, we don't want to be sort of, say, oh, you know, Western culture is better than all the other cultures or anything like that. But at the same time, there is this universe, you know, humanist universalism about values. And part of the way that you know, needle is being threaded following Sen, and I think, you know, a little bit of indirect influence from Rawls is this idea that, look, if universal human rights and universal values are really universal, you should be able to find sources for them in any cultural tradition. And you can, you know, he talks about this in Against the Web, you know, ways that you can find in like the Buddhist tradition, other traditions, you know, like there's a, you know, part of what was important to him about this is this anti-essentialism that's like going back to the earlier part of Against the Web, where he's bashing Sam Harris, that says, look, Sam Harris, no less than Osama bin Laden, you know, believes that there's such a thing as true Islam, that there's like the real kind and then like all the non-real kinds. But that's bullshit. Right. There is no such thing, right? Like this is like cultural and religious traditions are these vast things that include lots of people who are using the particular language of that cultural or religious tradition to express lots of different opposing values. And the ones that we like are going to find a place there. And, you know, you want to have, you know, so it's not actually carried about free speech or human rights, you know, equality for women. It's like these aren't actually distinctively Western things. There's in every culture, including so-called Western ones, you know, you get people who are both expressing that and the opposite of that, who are, you know,
No, absolutely. I mean, if you follow Jack Donnelly, who wrote a very interesting book on this, human rights in theory and practice, the world's first human rights code was introduced actually in Ashoka's India, right? Around the second or third century BCE, where, you know, Ashoka, drawing very deeply upon reservoirs of Buddhist wisdom, stresses again the universal equality of humankind, the fact that all human beings suffer and die ultimately, and that consequently, because we all suffer and die, the struggle for power after power is quite senseless. And instead, what we should try to do is focus on being compassionate and kind to one another. And from this, he issued his famous edicts, where it calls for religious toleration, dialogue as opposed to violence, and even introduces a couple of positive rights early on, talking about why the state needs to be helpful towards those who are most needy within it, right? So the idea that the West has some kind of monopoly on the notions of universal human rights or universal dignity is completely false, right? But one of the things that I like about Michael is Michael wouldn't sit there and say, just because the West didn't invent these ideas, it shouldn't celebrate them in some way, shape, or form, or they're not the possession of the West.
No.
His point would be to say, look, these people had a very smart idea there. We had a similar smart idea here. Why don't we use that as a jumping off point to talk about the things that unite us and think about how cool it is that people came up with these different ideas in very different points in history and time, rather than to try to foreground the things that make us different. And this is, again, why I really think he adopted this anti-essentialist stance. So this might be coming because I've read a truly unhuman amount of Thomas Sowell over the last couple of weeks, right? But Thomas Sowell has this famous defense of prejudice that he gives, which is that prejudice may be wrong or right, but it's kind of a shorthand that people make because it's easier to just generalize about entire groups and attribute essential qualities to them than it is to treat each person as an individual, because the cost-benefit analysis of having to treat each person as an individual is too high. So it's way easier just to rely on the stereotypes about you. For somebody like Michael, who is empathetic to his very core, that's not just extraordinarily lazy intellectually. It's a kind of abnegation of our human responsibility to look at the particularities of each individual and each society and to demonstrate a real curiosity about them, to expand ourselves through interacting with the other. And it's that ethos that is so anti-prejudice and anti-essentialism that I really found extraordinarily resonant reading his own work.
Yeah. So there's a point in the book where you you quote something. I'm actually not 100% sure. I think you told me before, but I don't remember where this comes from. I think these are just kind of some notes that he wrote that maybe the family shared with you.
Yeah, his mom shared it with me.
Yeah. So where he says that, hold on, there's I had it before. Let me find it again. Here we go. Yep, this is it. So he talks about four, you know, what he kind of thinks of as like four sort of pillars of the project. Number one, it says anti-essentialism. Essentialism asserts their characteristics all members of a group share, by which they're defined. So anti-essentialism, he's saying, is exemplified by the peerless work of Adolf Reed Jr. and other four real Marxist thinkers. It's a little, nice little dig there, the four real Marxist thinkers.
Yeah.
I'll leave, as they sometimes say in analytic philosophy papers, figuring out who the other ones are as an exercise for the reader. But in any case, Adolf Reed and the other for real Marxist thinkers. Two, internationalism. Not only are we all in this together, the rest of the world has so much to teach the United States. Let's do a reverse shift in power and deeply learn from and cohere with the rest of the world. Three, building a healthy culture. The left has many toxicities that can and often do make it a terrible place to be and not connected to the rest of the world. There's a class critique of this, which scholars like Vivek Chhibber describes, and there is a spiritual psychological dimension. Something else that he wrote, some notes that I was sent shortly after he died that, you know, he'd written just before, where I remember he included the phrase, we need both Adolf Reed and cosmic consciousness, which I remember thinking is a sentence only Michael Brooks could have written.
Yeah, that's for sure.
But the left needs to learn from and engage in these traditions, and in movements like liberation theology, we need to be able to deal with real human complicity and be good to each other. Which, you know, I mean, look, I'll certainly, you know, that is a, I think, a lot of people know, you know, I'm an atheist. I've talked about it. I've written about it. Michael used to lightly tease me about it on the show, that, you know, the, you know, there was a whole sort of running joke about astrology that I think kind of stood in for my squareness about all this stuff. But I actually vibe with this a lot. I think that, you know, as a moral worldview, I mean, this is going to sound funny coming from me, but it's true, right? Like, I think that, like, there are elements of Christianity, the sort of acknowledgments of human frailty and belief in redemption, that I like a hell of a lot better than whatever sort of moral worldview too many people on the left often seem to have. Just put it that way.
Well, I think this is actually a really important point about how he thinks the left should act interpersonally, right? And I think it's a really good thing that Michael was here to foreground this for us, because one of the things that religion does teach you, for better or for worse, is that personal conduct and interpersonal conduct really matters. And I think sometimes on the left, there's been this real emphasis on always looking at things in terms of impersonal systems. Now, of course, Michael was very capable of doing that, right? Again, kind to people, hard on systems, right? But he also understood that if you relentlessly criticize toxic or bad systems, and yet at the same time you don't behave as a particularly good person in your interpersonal life, that's not a great way to build a political coalition, because people are human beings, and if they don't want to be around you, then they're probably not going to want to politically align with you. And I think that one of the things that Michael really showed, and this is one of the reasons why his death was so mourned, was that being a good person who could make someone else laugh and just seem like a great guy to hang out with really can make a meaningful difference in terms of attracting people in the struggle to the struggle for justice, right? And that's a spiritual insight in a lot of ways that many religions have foregrounded. And I think there's definitely a way that even an atheist leftist can foreground the importance of that as well.
Totally. And yeah, number four this is where it cuts off. Just getting real about ideology and where it comes from, so we can do a serious and grounded analysis of the world, historical and material. Of course, this is a lot of what's going on against the web. Jake, if we could get the screen share set up. You know, we do have a clip of him talking about some of this stuff. But, you know, I guess what I really think about here, you know, you quote a little bit in the book, in your book, of the part of Against the Web where he talks about this, is the story that's in there that I actually told to him. I remember sitting at a bar in Brooklyn and
hey guys,
telling him this. That about David McReynolds, who, for people who don't know who that is, he died several years ago, I think like 2016 sometime, maybe 2017. But David McReynolds was a Vietnam era war resister. He was like in one of the pictures of the very first draft card burnings. He's like one of the four guys standing around wearing suits, burning his draft card. He was like a very, OG Socialist Party guy, you know, going back to very early in the history, you know, of that, the, you know, post-World War II, obviously, but, you know, the history of that party. You know, he was somebody who knew like Bayard Rustin and people like that. And, you know, I was, lucky enough to know him a little bit, you know, in the final decades of his life. There's the story that David, I remember telling once, and, you know, I told Michael and he quoted in the book, kind of connects with what we were talking about earlier, when the, Sputnik went up, David is, I think he's at a bar in Greenwich Village, and you know, they're like, I think maybe there's like a TV there, and they're watching the coverage of it. And he gets like super excited. He like leaps out of his seat. He's, you know, he's so jazzed about this. And like, you know, guy next to him at the bar is like, fuck you so excited about, right? He's like, we did it. You know, we put something up in the air. It didn't come back down again. And the guy says, oh, you mean the Russians did? And he said, no, I mean us, we, the human race, right? Like that's, and, you know, you can kind of see why he quotes that in the book. You know, this is this kind of, you know, universalist humanism that's sort of become alien to certain strands of both academic or political left thought. But, you know, but I think, you know, without it, that sort of, you know, kind of what you were talking about a minute ago, that sort of that spiritual insight about having to have this like positive moral vision to, you know, inspire people. You know, I mean, you just really don't get that without that.
Well, I don't want to go too much into the academies about this, but I think there are theoretical reasons why this transition happened. But beyond the theoretical reasons why this happened, I think that in many circumstances, the theory followed material and political reality, where once it became clear that a certain kind of socialist revolution wasn't going to be successful in the, say, 1968 and the 1970s, many people retreated into skepticism, particularism, identity, right? Now, there are good reasons for doing that, and I don't begrudge people turning to those sources for recourse, right? But it is a symptom to me of a faltering confidence, right, in the universal relevance of a leftist project. And what I think Michael really foregrounded and even anticipated was a left that was regaining a sense of confidence about itself and that did believe that its principles were universally applicable and could make people better off regardless of where they might happen to be. But a left that also internalized a lot of the lessons about the importance of particular struggle, context, foregrounding identity that, you know, people had really brought to the fore in those intervening years between 1968 and when Michael really rose to prominence. So I have a lot more to say about that. You know, you can read some of my work about postmodernity if you're interested in that. But, or yeah, you can read the book because I write about it a lot in there also, right? But that's kind of my two cents on that matter.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, let's watch. So what we're about to watch, this is the last live stream that Michael ever did before he passed away. We're not going to watch anything like the whole thing, but this is the first chunk where he's talking about the book.
Just doing a little brief live stream here. Having less time to do these, but still trying to get a few in. If you come in, let me know you can hear me well. And please, when you come in, of course, hit the like button. And if you can, hit us with super chats. That is hugely helpful for the YouTube channel and everything we're doing. I don't know. I don't know. Sometimes that happens automatically, actually. But hit us with super chats, and maybe I'll try to take a few questions. But I want to actually talk about a topic, make these a little bit more focused. And if you're a patron at patreon.com/TMBS, thank you. Let folks know. How good it is, how good the all the content is. And we need patrons, and we appreciate all of you as we do our work. Patreon.com/TMBS, TMBS.fm for awesome American union-made merch. So I keep thinking about this cosmopolitan socialist idea, which I wrote about in Against the Web. And what was interesting in that was I think that that model is definitely the one we need. I really do think that it's the answer to the reactionary forces that defend various historically contingent hierarchies. I think it's an answer, a dynamic answer to the resurgence of things like nationalism, which has obviously been very prevalent right now. There's a breakdown in the global system, and there's a breakdown of worldviews that is facilitating a lot of moves on the right. And it's also facilitating some moves on the actual left and some moves in the more sort of neoliberal discursive lane. And all of the toxicities and excesses that go along with things like, you know, the white fragility book and this type of stuff. And all I was doing with this cosmopolitan socialist idea was really to just try to say there is kind of a couple of basic blocks of how to look at the world. And one is that, and it's funny because they flip it either way. The traditional chauvinist, bigoted, imperial, settler, colonialist way is to say that there is a Western tradition, West is best, West has given us all of the good things, and other cultures either have to catch up or they can't. It's all some version of racism and paternalism built out of imperial and colonialist narratives. Now, there's this kind of countervailing force, actually, which sort of, you know, goes beyond the correct historical understanding of European imperialism, U.S. hegemony, and all these structures arising from capital and labor and race, to just saying like, no, actually, like the West is intrinsically evil. And all of this, you know, instead of it's the best, it's the worst. And the cosmopolitan model, what it really does is it says, and then the second model is really to say like, all cultures are distinct and different, and never shall they really meet. They're on different trajectories. And what's interesting is that there's right and left versions of all of these arguments, or I should say some people on the, I think ultimately either chauvinism or essentialism of any culture, or complete saying that there isn't global and cosmopolitan overlap. I think those are all fundamentally reactionary arguments, but sometimes you'll see them manifest in different guises. What the cosmopolitanism argument says in a really simple and basic way, and you could see this from all of the greats, whether we're talking about, you know, Amartya Sen or Cornel West, is that basically that like there is shared human desires, there is shared universal traits. Most all human beings really want the same things. There's a shared global human experience. But then there's also a variety of different contexts and ways of discoursing about those experiences and how to get there. So human rights are universal, which is a rejection of both the nationalistic and culturally particularist views. Every human being wants some sets of basic protections and economic abundance and speech and assembly and so on. But then how that manifests looks very different. And there's different traditions that have discoursed on rights in different ways. There's a great book by Amartya Sen called The Argumentative Indian, where he talks about how, as an example, the Indian tradition has multiple flowing sources for arguments in favor of democratic and open and economically just societies. And so I think that this cosmopolitanism with a ground in materialist politics and Marxist analysis of the economic base is where it is where things is the best way to go about things. We're in a global society. We're in a deeply interconnected one. We have to overcome all sorts of legacies of division, abuse, and oppression. But we also have to create cohesion, integration, and actually build models for things that are better. And part of how we do that is by really genuinely recognizing the global interconnectedness of everybody and really deeply reading from and going in between different traditions and synthesizing them, looking for synthesis, looking for points of reference. That's how we do this show. I think Amilcar Cabral has more to teach us about 2020 in the United States than almost anybody who's writing about 2020 in the United States. So this is my perspective. And the reason I want to bring in integral theory or some of the ideas around something called metamodernism, and I would check out Jeremy Johnson and Brent Cooper and Michelle Bowens with Peer to Peer Foundation. And this is like where, you know, it gets trickier. I've been kind of saying like, look, there is like a spiritual, for lack of a better word, element to this. Because in order to develop that, hey, Abstract, what's up? Let me just say, as you guys are floating in, please hit us with super chats. We need that. YouTube has been I mean, we've lost a lot of revenue on YouTube. The show is built around memberships and Patreon, which is the most important way. So go to patreon.com/TMBS. But, you know, we use YouTube to kind of get the show out, market it a little bit, and, of course, have the main show and all the clips. And that work is important. And, you know, obviously, all of that's key. So these super chats do help. So if you can, hit the like button and hit us with a super chat. And if I have time, I'll get to super chat questions. But sorry, before that diversion. So to get to this cosmopolitan socialist vantage point and to really develop this sort of empathy, the patience, the capacity at synthesis, and also complexity and nuance. This is not another moralistic story. We have competing social media driven, just various versions of mega stupidity right now that preach pure, you know, black or white binary narratives that don't have any room for human complexity, historical complexity, and rigor, right? And again, you know, you read Adolf Reed in Class Notes, that's the Adolf Reed reference. He really identified that. The delusion and moralism in the left that is only accelerated with woke culture. So this is a model that is about, like, what does it actually mean to be truly global to the extent we can, local, national, and international simultaneously, east, west, north, south, but from a place of actual growth and empathy. And this is where, again, this questions of consciousness come in.
That was really beautiful. I mean, honestly, there are a couple fucking minutes there that it almost felt like he was, you know, I don't want to say alive again, that's kind of ghoulish, right? But you could really feel, you know, the energy coming from his interaction with people and just how excited he was to see people and how enthusiastic he was about the show's future and how he had all these kind of ideas just pouring out of him about integral theory and dialogue and learning more about other cultures, right? It's just such a fucking shame.
Yeah. That's really, I mean, part of the reason I didn't want to edit out any of the sort of YouTube shop talk is just, like a, I really like that in its original context. Yes. Now that you get the that it's you know, this guy's also building a podcast and he was better at that than, you know, than anybody. And and yeah, I mean, I think you do get that passion about ideas. That again, this is like, you know, this is not somebody who just believed whatever left Twitter told him to believe, and, you know, no. Like whatever the opposite of what his enemies seemed to be saying that day was, or, you know, or anything like that. Right. I mean, he really thought deeply about all this stuff. He read everything. I mean, every, you know, like every time I was over at that apartment, you know, I mean, there were always, you know, there was always like, you know, at least one or two like half read books that, you know, were like open on the coffee table. You know, he would, you know, people would come on the show and, you know, you'd just start reading like everything they'd ever written. And yeah, I mean, you do get like how excited he got about thinking about all that stuff in that video. And yeah, that thing about, you know, that thing about, you know, compassion and empathy at the end. I mean, you know, you do get some sense of, you do get some sense of the vision there, and like, and, I think you also, yeah, I mean, you kind of said this a minute ago. I think a couple of people in the chat were saying that, like, you get some sense of what could have been. I mean, you already see in that. I mean, I kind of forgotten that he'd, like, set it up in a way that was, like, displayed in those live streams. I mean, I certainly remember seeing in his apartment from the last time I was there that picture of him with Lula.
Yeah. I was thinking that too. I'm like, Jesus, what would he have fucking said if he had actually seen Lula beat Bolsonaro, right? Probably would have been a banner day for Michael, right? Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, I think even just, you know, I mean, even in just like the reactions, you know, when he died, I think you can get a sense of it. I mean, he had like, the sort of spectrum of people who were, you know, taking a minute to remember him after he passed, included Lula da Silva, former and soon to be once again president of Brazil at the time. You know, I just have no doubt that this is sorry about that. I was in the moment and I forgot that I wasn't holding the mic. Usually I'm in the studio and, you know, don't have to think about it. I think it does give you some small sense of how big he probably would have blown up if he had been around for another year or two. And I know that was something he was always sort of constantly thinking about, kind of how to take these ideas more mainstream, you know, reach a bigger audience. I'll just, you know, maybe wrap us up on, the end of the introduction, you know, where, I mentioned, or not quite the end, but, you know, I mentioned, Lula a little bit, you know, cause, you know, I can remember, it is really funny to look back on this, that, you know, I'd started listening to TMBS, a couple months, you know, before I met the guy, and, my friend Mark Warren had recommended it to me. He said this, you know, like he seems to share a lot of, you know, the kind of feelings you often express about sort of the left being kind of more conscious about presents itself and all this stuff. And that was certainly true. And I obviously enjoyed it for the same reason everybody else did. And, you know, but being, you know, a bit of a completist about this stuff, you know, I went back to episode one and went back and listened to all the stuff that happened so far. And I have to admit, there was a point where it's like, it was, like the Lula stuff, you know, is describing the way, you know, that, the lawfare coup that had, with, you know, pretty obvious US complicity that had removed Lula from office and, removed Dilma from office and then framed up Lula, and imprisoned him so he couldn't run again at that time. I certainly thought that Michael was right about all of that. But you have to admit, like when I was like sort of binging through all those episodes of TMBS, there's a point where I was like, man, I've kind of heard the Lula thing already. Like, you know, why are we still talking about this? Like, this is like, you know, world full of injustices, right? Why this one, right? Why are we still on it? But, you know, he had this way of very charismatically getting people to care about what he cared about. And to the point that, you know, when I got the gig as a columnist for Jacobin, the first article I ended up writing was about Lula. That, like, you know, that he'd gotten in my head and, you know, had gotten me to care about this too. And I remember the next to last time, you know, I was already living in Atlanta then, but the next to last time that I stayed with him and his girlfriend in New York, I remember he was getting ready to fly to Brazil to interview Lula. And I remember how excited he was about that. I remember seeing, you know, the last time I was there, the weekend of that last TMBS live show, you know, seeing that he had that picture of him with Lula framed in his apartment.
Well, wouldn't you?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. I mean, fucking, I'd be hanging that thing right in the, it'd be like the Mona Lisa of my house.
Yeah. So, say in the introduction, to your book, the part of why Michael responded in the way he did to the figure of Lula had to do with his deep identification with liberation movements in the global South, with movements for dignity and equality everywhere. A detail that's always stuck in my head about the deep hatred of for Lula on the Brazilian right, despite the relatively mild nature of his social democratic reforms, is that wealthy Brazilians would often complain that as a result of the Workers' Party's efforts to create the middle class in the country, quote, the airports have started looking like bus stations, unquote. At the end of the live show we did at the Bell House in Brooklyn shortly before the pandemic started, he showed a clip of Lula speaking to a crowd shortly before he had to report to prison, orating in a way that sounded oddly dreamy despite having a voice as gravelly as Tom Waits. And quoting Che Guevara talking about how the powers that be can kill a few flowers, but they can't stop the coming of the spring. That kind of thing spoke to Michael in a deep way. But he also liked the way Lula cut through the political nonsense and ideological obfuscation and communicated in the kind of direct, visceral way so few American leftists seem to be any good at. The way he'd talk about making sure poor Brazilians had money to buy coffee and free time to watch soccer. Michael was, as much as anything else, a strategist, always thinking about how to make radical ideas mainstream, because, of course, that's, you know, that's the goal. As a smart German guy once put it, the point is to change it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really telling that in a world where many Americans, many of us in general, don't know anything about Brazilian politics or Indian philosophy, right? I would never care to learn about it. Michael saw nothing odd about trying to learn from all of the sources and caring about what went on, not because he was a cultural tourist or because he just had a kind of fetishistic interest in, you know, Taoism or Buddhism or what it happened to be, but because he really cared about the people that came from those cultures and wanted to learn from them and understand what they were all about and try to figure out if they might have something to teach him, right? And it's that combination of curiosity, empathy, humility, and a really deep sense of spiritual justice. That is what I took away from my interactions with him and from reading his book and from watching the show. And I can't say in good conscience that How to Guide Cosmopolitan Socialism embodies all of those characteristics, because, again, Michael was irreplaceable and nothing can. But it was my very best effort to pay tribute to those kinds of qualities. And I hope people enjoy it and receive it in the spirit in which it was written.
Yeah, absolutely. So read this book. It's good. Read everything everything by Matt. It's all good. So we are going to go to the post game for patrons. We have David Griscom waiting on standby for that. Say goodbye to Matt. So if you are already a patron, you should have a link to that in your inbox. If you are not, man, there is no time like the present. always I will never be I will never, you know, my Midwestern inhibitions are such that I'm never going to be as good as Michael Brooks was at working that into casual conversations. Oh, are you a patron? Gotta admire the hustle. But in any case, if you are a patron, I will see you with Griscom in about 2 minutes on the other side. Buy Matt's book. Left is best.